hello, hello. Then I'll ask you to sing in a minute. Hello, Anne, how are you?
Hello, Chicago.
I'm fine.
I'm Erin Allen.
I'm fine.
And this is Curious City.
And I hope that you are too.
You are hearing the voice of beloved singer, songwriter, and creator of children's music, Miss Ella Jenkins.
Hello.
What you immediately notice when you hear Ella Jenkins' music is that the kids are a part of making it.
Ella innovated call and response as a way of doing children's music. There's so much to be said about it.
That's Gail Wald.
We're going to play a little game now.
Author of This Is Rhythm, Ella Jenkins, Children's Music, and the Long Civil Rights Movement.
Well, you walk and you walk and you walk and you stop.
She says Ella transformed children's music away from singing at the kids to singing with the kids.
If you think about music classrooms in the 50s, where if you didn't have a good voice, you were told to shut up and mouth the words, while the people with good voices could sing. Ella changed all of that.
Before Ella Jenkins, Gail says children's musicians didn't really exist.
There were musicians who sometimes recorded for children. So anyone today who is trying to be a children's musician, or sometimes people say a family musician, they're working in her footsteps.
Stop, look and listen. Listen to what children have to say. Stop,
Gail says Ella took from black musical traditions she heard growing up on the south side of Chicago.
So it was both a kind of gesture to her own musical childhood, but also a radical way of reimagining what children's music could be.
We are America's children. We hope we are number one.
In our last episode, we learned that the first Chicago school named in honor of a black person was DuSable High School in Bronzeville. We also learned that that high school has a lot of notable alumni, including none other than Miss Ella Jenkins. So today, we're bringing you a conversation all about this music icon. I'm here with Curious City editor, Susie Ahn. Hi, Susie.
Hey, Erin.
So you talked to Gail Wald after her book came out.
Yeah, I spoke with her in front of a live audience at the 2025 Evanston Folk Festival.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Susie Ahn. I am editor for WBEZ's Curious City.
You learned a lot about Ella Jenkins' legacy and her impact on children's music.
Yeah, Ella lived a fascinating life. She was born in St. Louis and then moved to Chicago when she was four. And it wasn't an easy childhood. I'll let Gail Wald pick it up from here.
No, she was quite poor. Of course, her family were migrants to Chicago in the 1920s. Her mother was a domestic servant in Chicago. And like a lot of families during the Depression, in that situation, and the segregated South Side, they struggled. They moved every year. One of the charming things that if you met Ella, you learned very quickly is that she could recite a list of the addresses that she had lived in. She would talk about moving day every year being a day when the family hoped to move into a better apartment.
A neighborhood is a friendly place.
Girls and boys, when I was a child, my family and I lived in many different neighborhoods. In fact, every May 1st, we moved from one neighborhood to another. It was moving day for lots of people.
So this is a family of real strivers. What one of the things was incredible is that her mother, who really emphasized education, that Ella and her older brother Thomas both were college graduates, which was fairly extraordinary, especially for a woman, for Ella to have been a college graduate in the 1950s. Yeah.
And along with that, I mean, so her mother really had a focus on education, but music wasn't necessarily part of that. So she was not a trained musician.
Yeah.
But you write about these significant moments in her life where you can see that music development happening. Could you talk about some of those key moments?
So Ella would often say she wasn't a trained musician. It was a way I think she differentiated herself from the model of the children's music educator, who was often a trained pianist. Women often who went to college doing music and then they were not going to go into musical performance and they became teachers, but they were trained musically. She also had a critique of that idea of the trained musician, because of course, people throughout time in the world mostly learn music outside of music schools. They learn music through social interactions with the people around them. And that's exactly how Ella learned. In addition to kind of listening, she had big ears. Chicago, because the South Side was geographically small and a lot of different sounds were kind of mixed into the air together, so she had a kind of musical education just from walking down the streets of the South Side. But her first music teacher was her uncle Flood, who played harmonica to relax after work. And she learned the way that children, you know, in the South would learn without music lessons. He gave her a harmonica at some point. She would try to make some sounds. She would imitate him. And she describes this as, you know, when she would need some help, he would show her something. And that's how she learned. That's how she later picked up the drums, hand drums, which were her first kind of performing instrument, and later how she picked up the ukulele.
There was another point in her life that maybe on its surface it doesn't seem like it's a music development, but I see it as that, that she was a table tennis champ.
Oh, I know. I was totally into this. So writing this book, I learned a lot about table tennis because Ella was a table tennis, really a prodigy. So table tennis is super popular in the 40s and 50s. So in the park near where they lived, Ella's older brother, Tom, went to learn how to play table tennis. And of course, she did what her older brother did. So she went to play, and soon she could beat the boys. The first time that Ella Jenkins's name appeared in a Chicago newspaper was 1948, when she won the Chicagoland Women's Tournament. And the Chicago Defender noted in this little piece that Ella Jenkins had defeated such and such a name, comma, white. So, right, you think about that little piece appearing in the Defender in 1948, there was incredible pride. And a couple of Ella's friends told me, in their words, she was the Joe Louis of table tennis. So this is early training for Ella as a performer, probably the first time she had hundreds of people applauding for her. So in the book, I really thought about table tennis as a way of, you know, kind of mastering rhythm and kind of an agility with rhythm, that there was a way that it translated. And it was also a place, it was another place in American life where she had to kind of confront, you know, discrimination. There were white women who didn't want to play with black women. She saw other black women on the circuit. She intervened once when there was a black woman and her white opponent didn't want to play her. So that Defender story, it's like the beginning.
When she was in her 20s, Ella Jenkins moved west. San Francisco had a burgeoning folk movement at the time. Gail says her time there was musically transformational.
In the 1940s and 50s, women did not play drums. Drums were considered a male instrument. But kind of as she had with the harmonica, she decided she was going to learn drums, careless of kind of whether there was a precedent, whether there were any women who were already playing drums. She was interested in it. And characteristic of Ella, too, she was interested in learning the drums for her own purposes of self-expression. And she wasn't interested in, you know, what you might call virtuosity. The drum was a mode of communication, she discovered. A drum is about gathering people together. It's about gathering people for war, but it's about communicating. And so she was drawn, I think, to the communicative aspects of drums.
Rhythm number two with drum. Right, left, hold. Right, left, hold. Right, left, hold. Right, left, hold.
Living in San Francisco in the 1950s, Ella found work at a rec center teaching kids how to play table tennis. She lived at the Emanuel House, a boarding house for unmarried working Jewish women. Gail says she got close with the people who lived and worked there, and it was a place filled with music.
In that Emanuel House, music, because it was tied to Jewish ritual, music was part of everyday life. People sang the prayer before they ate. They sang the prayer after they ate. There was so music was integrated into everyday life in a way that I think was interesting to her. And she was observing for the first time, here's a different culture than mine where music is integrated into everyday life. What can I learn about this? What's different from my culture? What's the same as my culture? So she was very attentive to that. And it's also where she found out she could sing because you had to participate. And that was the first time she got up in front of people and sang, and she found out they liked the way she sang and that she had a good voice.
Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat 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 Shalom.
Gail says that Ella worked in Jewish community centers with people of all ages, but she always had a special rapport with children.
Ella wasn't afraid of children, and she always treated children with respect. And she was genuinely interested in children, not just kind of in a, isn't that cute? She was interested in them. She empathized with them. And so children knew that. And she was incredibly charismatic and had a sparkling personality and had a beautiful smile. All those things helped. And early in her career, she played exotic instruments like what's that drum? I've never seen that drum. So kids were drawn to these instruments that she played that they didn't know about. They could touch them. They could try them. It wasn't just about charisma. It was about a certain approach to thinking about what music was for in the world and how music could be a tool of creating community, of modeling multicultural democracy, many, many things.
I don't care where you
bury my body.
No, I don't care where you.
Gail says Ella's life's work was part of a bigger social justice project. She graduated from San Francisco State with a degree in sociology, and then she returned to Chicago. That's when she got a job working with teenagers at the YWCA.
These were mostly African-American teenagers, and she was interested in using music and also popular dances to teach Black teenagers about Black history. She would ask them, where are these rhythms from? What's the story of how these rhythms got to places like Chicago or got to New Orleans or got to other American cities? The kids weren't always receptive to that. There are stories that people told about sometimes they didn't want to hear about that. Mostly like other Americans, those kids were learning about Africa from movies that portrayed Africa as kind of an uncivilized place, you know. And so they didn't want to be associated with that. But Ella was really ahead of the curve in insisting, actually, no, we can think about African heritage. And a good way of thinking about it was through music. There was no institutionalized Black studies or African American studies in the 50s. There were important figures in different places doing that work, some of them in Chicago. But it wasn't institutionalized. And so she was very ahead of the curve in thinking about doing that and presenting material, you know, using the music again as a tool of educating.
And she would kind of tour in these, school assembly type touring and bringing that into the classroom. Talk a little bit about that. And I'm sure there were wonderful parts to it, but there were also challenging parts to that.
Yeah. There's a whole chapter in the book that talks about Ella in the early 1960s when she had a contract with something called the School Assembly Service, which is exactly what it sounds like it is. It was a booking agency for school assemblies throughout the upper Midwest. And Ella had that job for about 18 months. So she would go from school to school to school, middle schools and high schools, auditoriums. She would show up, and they had contracted for her to do an assembly. So this was a tough gig. But it was made tougher by the fact that she was traveling in the upper Midwest. And that travel was quite actually dangerous and risky for her. She didn't drive, so she always had a driver with her. There was a young man who was a driver for her who kind of lasted the longest. And the two of them would have to drive, go out of their way to find places to eat. They would have to go out of their way to find places to stay. It was not easy. Once they showed up at a school and they were asked what they were doing there, you know, there was concern about why they were lingering outside the school. And they said they were there early for the assembly. So it was a very unpleasant, working with the kids was pleasant, but it was a very unpleasant and difficult period of Ella's life.
Gail says Ella was having trouble maintaining her spiritual fortitude. Her school tour was happening at the same time as the Freedom Rides of the 1960s down south.
And in a way, Ella's work at that exact same time, in a very different context, was a kind of a freedom ride. She was appearing before audiences. Kids had never seen an African-American woman in a position of authority or as a teacher figure. There were kids who would sometimes say, you know, you look like the person who works in my home. So she would have to negotiate those kinds of things. So that was another kind of, so I think of it as a kind of Ella's freedom rides in the 1960s. And literally, you know, like the Freedom Riders, she covered probably hundreds of thousands of miles in those 18 months.
I don't know where he's gone.
I don't know where he's gone.
Ella had decided to devote her life to music. She brought a few songs to Folkways Records in New York City, run by Mo Ash, who was influential in popularizing folk in America.
Mo Ash was like famously picky. When Bob Dylan came a few years later and said, "Here, I'd like to record for you," Mo Ash said, "No, thank you, young man. I'm not really into it." Mo Ash went back and listened to Ella's work and got it.
Moon don't go,
moon don't go,
moon don't go,
moon don't go,
moon don't go.
Mo Ash was also interested in developing an educational market for recordings. So not only did he get Ella's music, but he could see a way that it could fit into his own aspirations for folkways to occupy a place.
Moon don't go. Moon don't go.
As a result of Ella's decision to work with Mo Ash and Mo Ash's support of her, Ella had an extraordinary career in terms of creative freedom and ownership of her material.
Her first album, Call and Response, came out in 1957.
Zimba,
Zimba,
Zimba, A,
Zimba, A.
The Ella Jenkins songbook came out in 1966. She owned the rights to her music, and the book had her name on it, which was rare at the time. Ella was a big fan of Billie Holiday, a musician whose experience in the industry had an impact on Ella, too. Gail says the first time the two met, both looked radiant in a photo they took together. But something changed.
And Ella would see Billie Holiday a second time in Chicago 5 or 6 years later. And Holiday was not looking so well. And when Ella asked her to sign an autograph book, Holiday said, "Well, let's take it in the light so I can see what I'm signing." Because she had been taken advantage of so many times. And I think Ella, those moments were instructive for her. She understood what the industry did to women, particularly black women. And she created a kind of a beautiful, self-sustaining, creatively independent path for herself as a children's musician.
Who fed the chickens?
I did.
Who stacked the hay?
Over her lifetime, Ella Jenkins created dozens of albums. She was known as the First Lady of Children's Music. She won a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 2004, and she appeared on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood 8 times.
Hi, Ella, come
hi,
in.
Hi, Fred.
I'd like you to know my television friend.
Oh, hi, friends.
Come on. I was just telling them about your music and all. Could I give you this?
Ella Jenkins passed away in Chicago in 2024.
Just a second.
She was 100 years old. Gail said getting to know Ella for this book was a privilege.
I got to know Ella at the end of her life. And her memory challenges were increasing as I got to know her. And toward the end of our relationship, she would stop. She didn't always remember who I was when she saw me, and I would have to say, "Oh, Ella, I'm writing the book about you, don't you remember?" And she would usually crack a joke and say, "Well, if you're writing a book about me, it's obviously going to be good." Which just shows you that she kind of had like incredible wit, underestimated wit and spirit, even when she couldn't. But it was moving to talk to someone who wouldn't necessarily always remember me, but who could also like pull up an incredibly important memory. I was privileged to get to know her. I really think Ella wanted her story told. So it was a privilege.
I've had a good time with you today, sharing songs, rhythms and rhymes and dances and games. Now it's time to go. Shake hands with friends. It's time to go. Shake hands with friends.
Gail Wald is a professor of American Studies at George Washington University and the author of This Is Rhythm, Ella Jenkins, Children's Music, and the Long Civil Rights Movement. She spoke to Curious City editor Susie Ahn. Susie, thank you.
Thanks, Aaron.
This episode of Curious City was produced by me, Justin Bull, and our editor, Susie Ahn. Music from this episode was all from Miss Ella Jenkins. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.